Hi, everyone, and welcome to The Week Ahead. I'm Tony Nash. Today, we're joined by Gary Brody, Tracy Schuchart, and Albert Marco. We've got some really interesting key themes this week. It's hard to get away from tech. So Gary's going to talk to us about tech and gaming, some really interesting insights into gaming, especially in China. Tracy's going to talk to us through coal and corn. We brought up coal a couple weeks ago. There's some interesting things happening in those markets as well. And then Albert is going to walk us through some of China's arms sales. We had the Singapore Air Show this week, and there's always buzz about how China's going to take over arms sales from the US and stuff. So Albert's going to talk us through that and help us kind of understand those markets better. So Gary, thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate you coming back. Hi, everyone. We've introduced new subscription tiers for CI Markets. More data, more insights, and more options. CI Markets uses the power of AI to help you make better trading and investment decisions. It's a perfect addition to your analysis toolbox. CI Markets Free is our first tier. It's absolutely free. No strings attached, and it does not require any credit card information. Next, we have offerings at $7.95, $14.95, and $24.95 per month. Each of these offerings includes different forecast assets for stocks, ETFs, commodities, and currencies. Go to CompleteIntel.com to find out more and subscribe. Hope you'll join us soon. This week, we can't get through the week without talking about tech. That wasn't the original thing that you and I talked about you coming on to talk about, but with NVIDIA, we just can't avoid it, right? So of course, NVIDIA reported big. Everybody knows that. They saw huge market cap growth of like $250 billion in one day. The day after their earnings announcement, which is amazing. And they've hit $2 trillion valuation since then, something like that. So, and they're one of, I think, three companies, Microsoft, Apple, and NVIDIA have that valuation. I believe I could be wrong on that. But what's interesting to me is this comparison of Cisco to NVIDIA. Cisco Systems back in 2000, 2001 to NVIDIA today. And this is a chart that people either love it or they hate it. There are very few people who look at this chart and go, I got no opinion on that. So here's what I think about this. You know, Cisco was the hardware that underpinned the first growth of the internet bubble. NVIDIA is the hardware that's underpinning the AI bubble or whatever we call the AI growth right now. So is that a fair comparison? I know the timelines may not be right. And, you know, whenever we put one graph over another, it's always really easy to go, oh yeah, that thing is just like that thing. So can you walk us through what your thoughts are on this?
Yeah, first of all, Tony, thanks so much for having me back. Always great to be speaking with you guys and sharing the stage with Albert and Tracy. So I actually think it's a smart comparison that I disagree with. And great. So let's go through why. The reason I think it's a smart comparison is because both Cisco, you know, 25 years ago, and NVIDIA today fall into kind of like the Levi Strauss picks and shovels thesis, right? So if we go back to the, you know, California gold rush of almost 200 years ago, most of the people mining gold didn't really make a lot of money at it. A lot of them went bankrupt. But the companies that consistently made money were the ones selling the picks, the shovels, the blue jeans, you know, the pans, whatever equipment was needed. You wanted to be the one selling to the people who might have a, you know, big stake or might go bankrupt. And so, you know, if we go back 25 years, Cisco was selling the server equipment that so many of the big, you know, dot-com companies at the time were buying, and that was the growth market at the time. One of the biggest growth markets we've ever seen. The whole world was switching from really a physical existence to more of a digital one and moving their shopping and interactions to online. And so, you know, that was phenomenal. NVIDIA, they are right now the best pick and shovel company for the coming AI revolution. You know, AI, it's not fully operational yet, but it's pretty easy to see that there's a lot of attention and money flowing into it. And so when we look at it, like, I think that's a smart comparison. We're saying, hey, we've got, you know, these two companies that are selling into, they're selling the hardware that the people making their big stakes are going to be using. But here's why I disagree with that take. Even though I think it's an astute take, I think the difference is the end customer, right? So let's go back, 25, 27 years, and Cisco was selling their servers to money-losing companies with business plans that consisted of spending massive amounts of cash to grab eyeballs, right? And that was why most of those companies went bankrupt. And, at the time, in 2000, 2001, 2002, I made a lot of money shorting the overvalued internet companies that were running out of cash and didn't really have a business plan other than spend money to get eyeballs. But when you look at NVIDIA now, they're selling to massive technology firms with high growth business models and tons of free cash flow. And so to me, the big difference here, and for the people who are looking at those charts and saying, these two look the same, wait a minute, it's the same thesis. Great. Okay. All of that's true. But my question for you is, would you rather be selling to Google or pets.com? It's really more of a hypothetical question for anybody who's making that comparison, right? They're putting the stock price chart up.
I would rather sell to pets.com because they were so stupid and spent money hand over fist. And Google actually has a procurement process. So but I understand what you're saying, because Google will be there to pay me in a month or two or three or 6 months, right?
So I think that's part of it, but let's go back for a minute, because it's not so much a matter of whether you get paid or not. If I remember correctly, Cisco's issue wasn't so much that they weren't getting paid. They were. Cisco was getting paid. But the problem was they were selling to a bunch of money-losing companies that went out of business. And when those companies went out of business, they sold their Cisco servers for 10 cents on the dollar. And so imagine a situation, and I don't think this is the case with NVIDIA, but imagine a situation where all of NVIDIA's customers started going out of business. They started selling, the A100 chips or the new version, I think is the B100 chip. But they started selling those at 10 cents on the dollar. That crushes future demand. And if that's the case, then NVIDIA would be hugely overvalued. And the reason why Cisco stock plummeted from the dot-com highs was it wasn't that their customers weren't paying them. It's that their customers went out of business and were selling their equipment at massive discounts.
Yeah. So I don't have a position on NVIDIA. I just want to be very clear. So I'm just pushing back on you for the theoretical kind of view here, right? So didn't we see NVIDIA chips sold for, pennies on the dollar after crypto crashed a couple years ago?
So I don't think that was so much the case. I think what happened, Tony, and there are people who have, who maybe know more about this particular part of the market than I, but I think what happened was the NVIDIA chips, their cards, were excellent for crypto mining. Mm-hmm. And so there was huge demand, not just from gamers, but from crypto miners. They could make a lot of money. Right. And as a result, the gray market in the NVIDIA cards went crazy. So, you'd see some of the NVIDIA cards where MSRP, the manufacturer suggested retail price, was maybe $400, but you couldn't find them at retail, and you had to buy them in the secondary market, sometimes for $1,000, $1,200. These cards were trading at two to three, or sometimes even four times the MSRP. And so what happened was when, you had that crash in the crypto market, you started to be able to buy the NVIDIA cards, more at that $400 price point. I don't think it so much represented a crash. I think what you had was a secondary market bubble that eventually cleared really at MSRP. And I was taking a look at this earlier this week. You still have a market where if we go to like the gaming market or like the high-end desktop market, you can still buy the 3060 Ti for, $250 to $300. Some of the new 4000 level NVIDIA cards you can buy for $400, $500, $600. And it's not until you get to like their 4090, their ultra high-end, and this is, not the AI version, but the regular cards, those are selling for $1,800 now. Now, if you get to like the AI cards where, you know, like the A100, I think MSRP on that is something like $17,000, $18,000. And some of those are selling in the aftermarket at more than $20,000. So it's not clear to
Amazing.
me.
It's
Yeah,
amazing.
it is. But the interesting thing is, new cards are still not trading at a discount to MSRP. So I don't think there's so much been a crash. I think you had a temporary bubble in people who were using those cards to make money. And there was a period of time when you could pay $1,000 for an NVIDIA graphics card and still make a profit in crypto mining.
Right.
Once that went away, the market went more back to the manufacturer's suggested retail price, but it's holding there. And even like the chip that I have the card that I have in my computer that I'm using right now is an NVIDIA 3060 Ti. I think that came out in 2020. But you know, even that, you're still looking at $300 to $400 for a 4-year-old card that you can buy because it's, you know, it's still phenomenal equipment.
So we had guys like Microsoft come out this week saying they're developing graphics cards to compete with NVIDIA or GPUs to compete with NVIDIA, other things. How imminent is that competitive threat? Is that something where a competitor can come out right away and compete with NVIDIA, or is it, for all intents and purposes, effectively a monopoly for another, say, 2 years?
So today, NVIDIA, they're clearly the market leader. They have the best solution. I think it's not realistic to expect that that is a, you know, nobody in the chip making business has a perpetual advantage, right? Everybody's advantage, particularly in the technology space, gets eroded over time. You know, can Facebook or Google or AMD or, you know, I don't think Taiwan Semiconductor is the right comparable company here. Yeah, there are other companies that have competing product that will come out with competing product. But that takes a while, right? That
Yep,
kind
it
of
does.
development, it doesn't happen quickly. And even once you have a theoretical design, getting it into production, like remember, like could Facebook do this? Sure, but Facebook doesn't own fab plants,
Yeah,
right? So they need to get those designs to Taiwan Semiconductor or, you know, wherever they're going to manufacture those. That doesn't happen instantly. So will there be competition for NVIDIA? Yeah, of course, but I don't think we're going to see enough of that in the next 12 months to knock NVIDIA off their perch. And you know, also remember, NVIDIA isn't going to stay still, right? So
yep, of course, yeah.
as these competing companies come out with new product, with better product, you know, NVIDIA isn't going to say, well, you know, we have our A100 chip and that's good for the next 10 years. They'll be developing
Yeah.
the second and third and fourth generation of that particular technology while these companies are trying to catch up.
Yeah, that's all fascinating. Albert, go ahead.
I didn't really take seriously those comments from Microsoft and others saying they're going to get into this, the chip making industry. I think that was more of a upcoming money grab because the U.S. government had announced some sort of like fund for semiconductors and whatnot. So I think that's more, they'll do the minimum that they can possibly do to get that money from the government. It was free
Sure.
money for R&D and whatnot. I just that's what I think most of it was
Okay.
geared
That makes
towards.
sense. Intel got some of the money this week. GlobalFoundries got some of the money this week. So okay, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah,
Okay.
and that's a great point, Albert. Think about it this way. I think the US fund for those plants is something like $40 billion. A lot of it hasn't been awarded yet. So, you know, somebody could say, well, you know, what does Facebook need $5 billion? They don't, but if you could issue a press release and get a few billion dollars of funding, you know, that's pretty good return on investment.
Yeah, Tony, why don't we do that with Complete Intelligence?
Let's do it today, right now. I'm making the announcement. Okay, so guys, for stocks in general, we're seeing the top 10% of stocks as a large share of the overall market, more than any time since the Great Depression. So we've seen the FANG stocks hit things, for the last 4 years, right? It's really driven the market. Is that concentration or lack of breadth, is that important? Is that something we need to be paying attention to? If so, why or why not?
So I think it matters for two reasons. One is right now we have an S&P 500 that, you know, used to be a proxy for industrial America. That's almost entirely determined by seven stocks. And, you know, if you look at the news over the last week, that's actually been cut to two. We've gone from talking about the Magnificent Seven to, I think they've branded, you know, Microsoft and Nvidia the Terrific Two. And so we have this sort of competing debate where people are talking about the market being at all-time highs. Great, but most stocks aren't. And there are a lot of stocks that are nowhere near their highs or even down. And even yesterday, where, you know, depending on which index you were looking at, the market was up 2 to 3%, something like 55% of stocks in these indexes were down on the day. And so here's what's happening. You have the market at all-time highs, but most stocks aren't. And what this does is it forces asset managers who are benchmarked to the index to pile into a very, very small number of stocks that are working or their performance lags. And, you know, if you're a mutual fund manager, you trail the index by 50, 100 basis points 1 year, no big deal. Start to trail by 200, 300 basis points 2 years in a row, you're going to be looking for a new job. And what it does is it forces these asset managers to pile into the two or three or seven stocks that are the most overvalued and are working or their performance lags. And so this exacerbates the problem, becomes, you know, Soros talked about reflexivity, which is basically the tendency of a trend to create the conditions that cause the trend to intensify. The other reason I think it matters is if we go back through history during the other times when we had excessive concentration. So let's talk about like the tech bubble of the late 90s or the Nifty 50 in the 1970s. Most investors at that time were picking individual stocks. And even if it wasn't, you know, stock pickers like myself, you had, you know, mutual fund managers that were mostly picking individual stocks. But now we have a situation where passive management has gone to more than 50% of the market. And so when that happens, you have more and more non-discretionary money flowing in to the market. And, you know, just remember, the more overvalued a stock is, the larger it is as a component of the index, the more money that flows into that. And so it again becomes a self-reinforcing, the more money that is in passive investing, the more there is a tendency for overvalued stocks to be bought more and become more overvalued, and for undervalued stocks to be bought less and become more undervalued. And so, you know, is that great for the market? No, not necessarily. But on the positive side, it does create some great long-term opportunities for individual stock pickers who realize that none of these trends go on forever.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, so many people are saying, well, not so many, there are a number of people who are saying, well, you know, tech's gotten way out of line. We're going to see this downturn, because I guess that reflexivity has, in their minds at least, hit that brittle point, right? To where there's really not much elasticity to the upside anymore. In their view, it's not what I'm saying that you're saying, but you know, it is a really interesting observation about reflexivity and concentration. So does that worry you that the rest of the market isn't necessarily participating, or are they just behaving normally? Is it more just a segmentation exercise where they're behaving normally within their segment generally? I know there are exceptions to everything, but are you seeing these things behave relatively normally?
Yeah, I don't necessarily see massive problems in the rest of the market. You know, the stocks are starting to trade again, less off of Federal Reserve announcements, less off of macro, less off of, you know, some random Fed governor was, you know, somebody put a microphone in front of them when they exited their house, right, and they said random things. And, you know, these stocks traded. Stocks are now starting to trade off of valuation, off of earnings, revenue growth, things that actually matter, fundamentals. And so, I think there's opportunity if you're willing to look at these companies and do the work and be patient. If you have a longer time horizon than the next, you know, week or two, you can do really well in some of these names. The thing that I think is really interesting about the dominant narrative on tech is both sides of this, the bulls and the bears, are pointing at the same data, the same information as proof for their point, right?
The Cisco and NVIDIA chart. It's same thing.
That's over it. And over again. Right. And so what we had was, you know, people were saying the NVIDIA earnings announcement is going to be the most important earnings announcement of all time. And people made fun of it, except it actually was true, because they beat, they gave guidance above street expectations. We not only had a giant rally in the US, there was a worldwide stock market rally. The entire world traded up on the basis of one company's earnings report. Now, granted, it was a great earnings report, right? And so, you know, the bulls are saying, look, this really does matter. And you have one or two companies driving the show. And this is we predicted this and our thesis was right. And you know what? Like, good for them. They nailed it. The bears are saying, wait a minute, this is crazy. This is not healthy. And you've got one company determining worldwide stock performance and valuations. And this is not sustainable. And you have a very, very fragile house of cards here. And that's not crazy, but you know, it's worth pointing out that both sides are pointing to the same data as proof that they're right.
Yep. I love it. It's so interesting to me when I see that. Tracy, what do you think about this kind of breadth discussion? Is that something that you consider as you look at markets?
Well, you know, I mean, I obviously am in an entirely different sector of the market of where my focus is. You know, I do think it's very interesting. And I posted a chart earlier this week where it showed XLE, which is literally most of the energy companies, via, you know, versus NVIDIA. And NVIDIA's market cap is higher than XLE. And their earnings are one fifth of what XLE's earnings are. And so I just think that's very interesting from the perspective when I'm looking at, you know, commodities, markets, and how things are trading against the tech sector.
So does that tell you anything? NVIDIA is overvalued, energy is undervalued, or we're just in a range where it's acceptable for those things to be valued as they are?
Do you draw conclusions from that? You know, I have to go back to what Gary said, is that, you know, this market's forcing everybody into the tech sector. And I also did post another chart this week that I talked about on Spaces today, where I showed the influx in the tech sector compared to every other sector in the market. And it is a giant pile in. So I don't know if that necessarily says anything bad or good about the commodity sector. I would just say that it's largely disregarded right now because this is a big fad. But at the end of the day, you know, I have to piece together that if you want all of this AI computing, what do you need in the end for this? Energy, right? Because all of these data centers require a lot of energy. And so I think this all ties back together. And I think the market just really hasn't wrapped its head around how big of an energy suck these data centers are really going to be, and how much energy and energy infrastructure we're going to need to build out for this.
Everything comes back to energy. It's crazy. So, hey, I'd like to make sure you know that you can access our AI-driven market forecasting tool called CI Markets for free. No strings attached, and it does not require any credit card information. Go to completeintel.com/markets to subscribe. CI Markets is the perfect addition to your analysis toolbox. This free account includes Nikkei stocks, major currency pairs, and global economics. Of course, we offer much more in our paid account, but this lets you experience CI Markets before making a financial commitment. CI Markets uses the power of AI to help you make better trading investment decisions. It's absolutely free. Again, go to completeintel.com/markets to subscribe to CI Markets free. Okay, let's move on to gaming. Gary, you in a recent newsletter wrote about gaming stocks, and partly as a reflection of the health of China's economy. So we've got this chart of Macau Golden Week tourism data. Can you talk us through what that means? Like, what is that chart telling us, and what's happening with the gaming sector?
Yeah, thanks, Tony. So the reason we've been focused on this at Deep Knowledge Investing is we have a huge position in Las Vegas Sands. Despite the name Las Vegas in the name and the company's name, Sands sold their Las Vegas casino a few years ago for a huge price. They sold their Bethlehem casino quite a few years ago. And at this point, they have leading market share in Macau and half the market in Singapore. So it really is an Asian gaming company, despite the name. And what's happened is, of course, all of these stocks traded down during the COVID lockdowns because China remained locked down for 3 years, right? And in Macau, you had situations where not only, you know, was the entire place locked down, but, you know, one person would test positive for COVID they would shut down the entire place and do 750,000 COVID tests in a day. And so nobody wanted to go and nobody could go and everything was locked down. Okay. So a year ago, China reopened and they basically said, you know what, we're going to get over this all in a week or two. The entire country got COVID in like a 2 week period and they just reopened all at once. And what's happened is Las Vegas Sands stock hasn't traded back to its pre-COVID levels. But if you look at the market in Singapore, the Marina Bay Sands, that is actually performing at all-time record levels. It's performing better than pre-pandemic levels. And if we look at Macau, Macau has really made, at this point, pretty much a full recovery. And so what we did was we compared the visitation during Golden Week or Chinese New Year, Happy Year of the Dragon, everyone. And during the first 5 days of this year's Golden Week, Chinese New Year, what we had was visitation that exceeded the 2019 levels. Now, that always drops off later in the week. In 2019, it was a 7-day holiday. This year, it was an 8-day holiday. But if you take a look at the daily average visitation in 2019, that was 173,000 people per day. This year was 170,000 people per day. So we're at 98, 99% of the pre-pandemic levels. But the reason things are better is because most of there's been a shift and most of the gaming now is taking place in the mass and premium mass market. And that's where Las Vegas Sands really excels. And that business has up to a 10 times, the margins on that business are about 10 times what they are for the VIP business. So the fall off in the VIP business is bad for companies like Wynn, where they're looking for that kind of gambler. But for Las Vegas Sands, which is really focused on the mass and premium mass market, they're putting up pre-pandemic level performance. The market is fully recovered. Now, one of the reasons the stock hasn't traded back all the way is because people are understandably concerned about the Chinese economy. There are worries about the banking sector, the property sector, the cross-contamination between all of that, the leverage in the system. And I understand that. But the fact is, after 3 years of not being able to go to the gambling tables, which in many ways is the Chinese national pastime, people, they've got pent-up bankroll. And just like we saw in the United States in late 2021, in 2022, Americans who had felt locked up in their homes went out and started spending in restaurants, casinos, concert tickets, sporting events. This is what the Chinese people are doing. And so visitation in Macau has just gone, you know, it's basically at pre-pandemic levels, but the stock hasn't fully recovered yet. And, you know, the gamblers are choosing not to recognize the difficulties in the Chinese economy.
Yeah, it's interesting. So what I'll kind of add on to what you're saying, and let me know what you think about this, but for China to get out of their economic doldrums, they're going to have to unleash fiscal spending as well, right? So they've had these market issues where they said you can't sell or buy during certain hours or whatever, but they're going to have to unleash fiscal. And just like we saw here in the US in 2021, whenever there's massive fiscal spending, there's also massive corruption, right? And, you know, not an easy thing to talk about, but casinos are a great way to launder money, right? So if we have visitations up and we have massive fiscal stimulus as well, does that also help the casino business in Macau and Singapore?
You know, Tony, it's hard to say, only because casinos historically have been a place where people went to launder money. But at this point, these businesses are so heavily regulated and so heavily monitored. I'm not saying it can't be done, but it's pretty dangerous. And okay, you know, remember, you walk into a casino, they know who you are. They're tracking you. If you win money, they're tracking you. If you take money out of an ATM there, they're tracking you. It's not necessarily the best place to go and try to bring a whole bunch of ill-gotten gains and launder it.
Okay. No, that's good to know. I mean, that the industry has changed a little bit. I think that's really interesting.
It's also worth pointing out that as part of the retendering agreement that they had a year or so ago, you know, the government has officials pretty much on the board of every one of these companies. So, listen, could they be bought? Yeah, of course they could. But again, there's a lot of oversight here.
Okay, good. That's good to know. Okay. Thanks for that, Gary. I really appreciate it. Let's move on to energy. Tracy, you posted some really interesting tweets about coal and corn, not the same issue, this week. And I wanted to really bring them up and get more color on them. The first is coal in China. Okay, so Gary's saying, you know, we've had people return to casinos. China's economy is returning to, I guess, normal or approaching it. So the Chinese government approved a bunch of new coal capacity, and their emissions were reported to have risen in 2023. So that to me is a little bit odd for the country that produces more solar and wind than anywhere. Can you tell us more about this and why it's happening?
Well, first, I want to talk about solar and wind is coming from a very small base in China. China is also a huge, huge country, right? And so if you take 2023, for example, they built a record 291 gigawatts of solar and wind together. It was about 216 of solar, 75 of wind. But that sounds like a huge amount if you're Brazil. But if you're China, you're talking about 4% of the country's total demand. And so this is a very different situation. And so, yes, they may be surpassing the world in this capacity, but compared to what their demand is, it's a very, very small base. That's one thing we need to, you know, start off by saying. The second is that solar and wind can't be base power. They can't be base load power. And so they're building out coal because it's cheap. And they need base load power. You can add in wind and solar, but they cannot serve as a base power like natural gas or uranium or nuclear or coal can. So I think we need to differentiate the two, because I know a lot of people on Twitter say, but they're building out so much solar capacity and so much. Yeah, but it's coming from a very small base. You have to realize how big the country is, how big their demand is, and how very small this huge build out is of their actual demand. And at the end of the day, you need base power. And so, you know, China's still building out coal plants. It's cheap.
I love that you pointed out that over the last 2 years, the amount of coal power they've produced could power all of Brazil. I think that's so interesting, right? I mean, Brazil is not even close to the magnitude of China in terms of economic performance.
Well, absolutely. But it's just it's a comparison so that you can understand what we're, you know, what we're kind of talking about is country to country, right? And Brazil is no small country in and of itself. So,
right. And turning to the CO2 emissions part of that tweet, you said that their emissions are 5.2%. Interesting to me that that's right around where the Chinese government said their economy grew last year. So, you know, it's kind of funny that, you know, their growth and their CO2 emissions are kind of in the same ballpark. So how, you know, are they, I mean, we remember 10, 15 years ago when people talked about clean coal, right? And we say that kind of sarcastically, but are they doing things to mitigate pollution with these new coal plants? And do you know what that looks like?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. Everybody is at this point, right? So you say, you talk about clean coal and it's not clean, but it's cleaner because technologies have advanced and right. So on and so forth. And this is being used the world over. And so, you know, it's not the coal of the, you know, mid 20th century.
Right.
Right.
China's probably, since these are new plants, they're probably building in, you know, scrubbers or whatever they're putting in to keep that soot from going into the atmosphere and to keep that CO2 from going into the atmosphere.
Absolutely. So it is clean coal in that respect, 100%. But, you know, They're still, well, their economy is contracting at this point, but they're still growing economy. They still want cheap coal. That's why we see India doing the same thing. They're building out coal plants as well. And you're going to see this across emerging markets, right?
And they need power for all those electric cars.
So, and you need to power electric cars, right? So where are you gonna get that power from? It's not coming from solar or wind. And so there is a discrepancy. And so, yes, we can say, yes, China's building out the most solar and wind out of any other country, but what is this compared to their total overall demand?
I also think it's worth pointing out how incoherent our energy policies are. It's consistent with Tracy's point. We have Western countries that are shutting down coal plants, supposedly for environmental reasons, but what we're doing is we're pushing our manufacturing and production to countries that are building coal plants and saying, look, we got our emissions down. Well, all we've done is outsourced our pollution.
That's
Well,
right.
100%.
That's right. And the green mechanisms that they're using to kind of mitigate that stuff have some pretty dirty processes in their manufacturing too. So it's
Everything does. Yes.
on net, I'm not sure that you're really doing much. Maybe we are, but
Yeah, mining lithium, it does not lead to zero emission vehicles. It just means we've moved them in time and space.
Exactly. That's exactly right. So Tracy, let's move on to corn. The Biden administration approved the expansion of E15 gasoline sales starting in 2025, which to me is funny because it's after the current term is over. So what does this mean? Why is it happening now? And why isn't E15 approved without restrictions now?
Well, generally, E15 is banned, especially during summer, because it produces smog. Though, if you ask the Corn Belt states, they will dispute this. But this has been the rhetoric of the EPA and whatnot, is E15 is very much smog producing. And so you can only really have that during the winter. And we don't even really produce much of that during the winter, in winter-grade gasoline. That's it. So really, what do we have to, how should we break this down right now? So first of all, obviously farmers have been pushing this for a while, especially in the Corn Belt, or Corn Belt states have been pushing for this. And so I think at this point, I think this is an attempt to get the farm vote, to be honest,
Which
right?
Albert has talked about for 9 months,
Right.
right?
And so, because we have seen the farmers kind of moving away from the Democratic Party because of a lot of their other environmental mandates that are very hard on farmers. And so I think this is kind of a last minute ditch effort to kind of get those votes. That said, it doesn't start till 2025. And so the Corn Belt states are not exactly excited about that because it's, after this summer, which they really wanted this summer. Now, why did they want it this summer? Well, right now we have record corn stocks and silos. And so we have sinking corn prices right now. The problem is when we head into the next plant season, is that we have very, very tight fertilizer supplies. And that means these corn farmers are not going to make any money because it's all going into fertilizer. And so, they need to get rid of their corn now. They wanted this to happen summer of 2024. And so this could alleviate some of the pressure on them. And so that's what we're looking at right now.
So it's not really a political bone for this presidential. I mean, it appears like it is, but it's not really going to get any votes this year.
Probably not, no.
I mean,
Not, not.
may get urban votes of people who think that it's helping the environment, but it may likely won't get farmer votes, right?
Right. But if you look at the general consensus of, when they have done polls on this, many people are angry because consumer prices are so high on food right now. They want to know, why are we burning this in our cars when, when I'm seeing grocery store prices for grain related products skyrocket. And so, the consensus on that on the consumer side is very different than I think that the government actually sees right now.
Interesting. Yeah, it's the same 2007-08 kind of food is fuel type of discussion, right? Albert, right. What were you about to say? Sorry.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's other ways to boost corn prices for farmers, especially going into Senate races and, you know, in 2024. I mean, if you look at corn, I was just doing the hilariously before I even looked at the notes, I was doing the charts for corn for a client, and 390 to 400 is actually a better opportunity than 350 was in 2020. In fact, that corn is actually down 10% from January 2020, and usually corn prints March lows after sell-offs. So, you know, the chart history looks interesting. I like the politics of it. And, you know, we're actually starting to get pretty big in the corn starting now.
Great. Very.
Is anyone else concerned at all about damage to engines?
No.
The E15 doesn't.
Actually, it's been well known, though.
Everyone knows about this and they just don't care. It's just that, you know what I mean? They see the thing. They just, what do they care? You know? Because their thinking is, oh, the damage to the engine goes when it's over 150,000 miles. I'll be out of that car anyways at that point. So, I mean, it's just I understand it. Everyone knows about it, but nobody seems to care about it.
I might push back on that a little. There's a lot of sites now that you can go find gasoline with no ethanol whatsoever in it. And I know, you know, personally, I buy gasoline with no ethanol in it. Sorry, farmers, but I do. So.
It's expensive and it's sporadically. I've done the same thing here in Tampa, and it's sporadic where they actually have it, and it's more expensive.
It is more expensive, yes.
Yeah,
there's a very large chain here in Texas called Buc-ee's one of the reasons people go there is because they consistently have it. And so I have friends who will drive, you know, 40 miles to a Buc-ee's to get gasoline that they're sure has no ethanol in it.
Yeah, so, they have that at Wawa here in Southern Florida. Why did I say Southern California?
Close, almost. There are enough Californians there that it should be Southern California. So, okay, let's move on to our third topic that talks about China is arms sales. So, Albert, we've seen a lot of chatter about China's arms sales this week, particularly to the Middle East. As I mentioned, it's Singapore Air Show this week. So there's a story out in the South China Morning Post from this week talking about their FC-31 fighter in Saudi Arabia. And there was a discussion about a new Chinese helicopter at the Singapore Air Show. It's notable that, you know, Russia wasn't at the Singapore Air Show this year because of sanctions. So it looks like China's trying to grow into that segment. I don't know how feasible that is. I'd love to hear about that. I guess it's also important to understand that the U.S. is by far the world's largest exporter of weapons, followed by Russia, France, and then China. So can you help us understand, is this realistic that China kind of takes over arms sales in a big way? And who would they take out if they, who would they take market share from if they're to do this initially?
The only ones they would take market share from would be Turkey and Russia in reality. But I mean, it's not really a serious threat to those two nations. Certainly not a serious threat to the United States. I mean, the weaponry that the U.S. has is so far superior. On top of that, the supply chain and logistics for where all the parts are made from not only comes from the United States, but also European countries, which benefits them. So the only reason that Saudi Arabia and these other nations even entertain these weapons from China is because they get trade deals based on it. You know, you buy our oil, we buy your, you know, we buy your weapon, you know, we buy your crappy airplanes and helicopters that will probably collect dust for the next 10, 15 years. You know, it's not, it's just not really a credible threat.
So some of the stuff that I've seen this week is also talking about Chinese arms manufacturers putting manufacturing sites in Saudi Arabia. Is that, how feasible is that? And does that make that equipment more attractive?
No, it's not. I mean, their technology has always been subpar. The materials are subpar. Their engineering is subpar. I mean, like I said, this is purely reminiscent of what BRICS was, where they're just doing, you know, quid pro quo trade deals, nothing more than that.
Okay. Albert, can you talk to us a little bit about how this contracting happens, just some basics of it, because I know it's really sophisticated. And, you know, I know the US and the Germans and others have this down really well. Mm-hmm. Is it a hard thing to break into from a contracting perspective? We don't need to get into the mundane details of it, but kind of in general.
It's about as hard as getting a suitcase full of money and shifting it over to the CCP guys. I mean, it's basically a bribery campaign, and the Chinese are okay with it, and the Middle East is okay with it, and it is what it is. It's just, you know, it has to go through legitimate governments in the Middle East, you know, up the chain to the PLA. It can't just be, you know, a broker, you know, wanting to buy some Chinese parts and so on and so forth. A lot of the Chinese parts are actually sanctioned by the US and other countries.
Okay. And so who would they target? I mean, the UAE, Saudi, like who are the prized governments to have their equipment in the Middle East?
Well, obviously the Saudi Arabians, Qatar is another one. I mean, that's been a big tug of war between Russia, Turkey, and obviously China wants to get in there. Those are the countries with the big pockets. They're the ones with deep pockets and can actually afford to pay $4 billion for, you know, antiquated subpar equipment.
Right. And Iran obviously is already a big customer. Right?
Well, Iran is a little bit different. I mean, they try to develop their own stuff and they get a lot of stuff out of the Russians and some stuff out of the Chinese. But there's just nobody really trusts the Chinese, especially if you're – why would you trust the Chinese if you're Iranians, where you actually have a possible conflict coming in the future?
Sure. That's a great point. Perfect. Guys, thank you so much. This has been fantastic. I really appreciate your time and all your thoughts. So have a great weekend. Have a great week ahead. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tony.